online or not. So, hello? 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 So, perfect. Let's just assume you hear what I'm saying. So, today was a campus radio promotion where I, your humble host, served delicious ice cream cones. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Boyang, your host for the next half an hour or less. Well, I was just in the Louis Beer Garden where I protected myself against parasitic wasps, which of course has some side effects on my central nervous system. Of course, that won't hinder me to pleasure you with today's Talking Science. Talking Science, the established science program on campus radio that crosses the web for cutting-edge scientific discoveries and technological innovations and copy and edit them into digestible sound bites for your convenience. Last week, we stopped at our highly recommendable science advice on dating. We'll wrap that up and continue with exciting stories like the roots of autism may be in the skin. How parasites make you dig your own grave, literally. 1,500-year-old gut bacterial hype archaeologists, and how octopus avoid tangling up their own worms. And a religiosity of the menstruation cycle, which was the story of last week, but I wasn't able to finish it due to time constraints. And of course, another important science advice, especially for students, how to get better asleep. From conversation, bringing flowers to your next date apparently increases your chance of getting laid. The advice currently only applies to men. Nicolas Guéguen from University of Southern, Brittany, France, ran several experiments and discovered that women are more susceptible to male rapprochement in the presence of flowers. It seems flowers can influence women's perception of a male's attractiveness and dateability, whether in a lab or in a shopping mall. It is possible that flowers' close association with romance is responsible for the effect, or it may be that flowers put people in a good mood and that makes them more generous in the ratings of others and their subsequent behavior. Of course, it would be very interesting to know what objects or locations prime men to be more susceptible to womanly charm. So, in conclusion, don't forget the flowers and ask for her number. And if it doesn't work, maybe you're just too ugly. Next story by Thomas Rees. He wrote on Field of Science about how a woman's fertility affects her religiosity. Last year, he wrote about an interesting study that found that single women were less religious than when they were most fertile, while women in a relationship were more religious. So Christine Harris from University of California, which is in the United States, and Laura Mikes from University of London, which is in London, also thought the results were pretty remarkable, and they set out to see if they could reproduce them. So they repeated the study, but with a larger pool of responders, and the results are clear. Stage in the ovulatory cycle had no effect on religiosity or on social attitudes, or on physical attitudes, which was included as a control. So women, at least the ones interviewed for the study, do not turn to religion and social conservatism when they are at their most fertile. And social attitudes do not change on a whim. And the results did confirm that women in established relationships tend to be more religious and more socially conservative, which is pretty much you'd expect from other data. The question is, of course, cause or effect. So two studies with basically the same design with different results. Of course, this study is just one of a growing number of failures to replicate several menstrual psyche effects on preferences and traction, which invites concerns that this literature as a whole may have a very high false positive rate, well above the widely presumed 5%, which is not on topics like menstrual cycle, but in the whole area of psychology and other scientific disciplines. The problem may be due to the data analysis flexibility. Researchers often play around with the data, refining their analysis until they get something that clearly demonstrates the effect they're looking for. It's a very common temptation, but it renders any statistical analysis rather meaningless. And Thomas suggests that researchers should declare in advance exactly what they want to do and then follow that plan to the letter. But this approach, while rigorous, means that you can't go digging in the data to try to unearth anything you want to see. The solution is to do an exploratory analysis and then run another full study to confirm what you found. But again, who has the time and money to do that? Academics are often under immense pressure to pump out new study results in order to keep the job. And you don't get paid for not finding things. Our next story by Stephanie Pappas on life science. Octopus are amazing animals, and their arms are amazing things. They have their own nervous system apart from the brain. They live on for an hour after being amputated. They move on their own. They spot hundreds of suckers that grasp things reflexively, and they can bend and stretch in seemingly infinite combinations. Octopuses are incredibly dexterous. They can twist open screw top jars, peel apart oysters, and otherwise manipulate their environments with their agile arms. These arms have their own mini nervous systems that can control movement without contacting the octopus brain. So humans also have some motor reflexes that can occur without the brain's input. But these reflexes tend to be very simple, like the knee-jerk response that happens when a doctor taps your kneecap. You can also do that yourself. Without much danger, I would assume, but always consult a doctor when you want to do anything to yourself, as ever. But all those features should mean that octopus spend most of their time as big knotted bundles of limbs. After all, imagine how difficult it would be to have 8 arms that literally had minds of their own flailing around your body. Now, a new study finds that octopuses solve this independent arm problem with skin excretions that prevent arms from grabbing one another. The octopus arm, in comparison, can live on after amputation, crawling around and grasping anything in its path. And amputation is quite common in the wild. Octopus arms regrow after they are lost, and octopuses may even eat their own arms or those lost by others. So the researchers of the new study first amputated arms from the common octopus, or in Latin, octopus vulgaris, and let the arms interact. Of course, the octopuses were anesthetized before losing their arms, although the animals don't seem to be very bothered by arm amputation, because apparently it happens very often in the wild. The team found that amputated arms would not grab each other, nor would they grab octopus arm skin stretched over a plastic dish. An amputated arm would grasp another arm that had been skinned, which is very interesting. So, clearly something about octopus skin was protecting the arms from one another. So, what? The researchers suspected some sort of chemical excretion. To test this idea, the researchers used chemicals to extract the substances on octopus skin. They then smeared the extract on plastic dishes and offered them to amputated octopus arms. For comparison purposes, they also offered dishes smeared with fish skin extract and with a neutral gel along to the octopus arms. They found that the octopus arms again avoided association with octopus skin. Their grasp on the octopus skin smeared plastic. So the grasp on the plastic that was smeared with octopus skin was 10 times weaker than their grasp on plastic smeared with gel alone, and 20 times weaker than the grasp on fish smeared plastic. So, yes, octopus arms still grasp for food, even if they are detached. But what they do is they tend to grasp plastic that has not been smeared with their own skin. Or the skin of other octopus, maybe. The text is not clear on that. So next, the researchers took the study to live octopuses, but that's where things got weird. Sometimes octopus would eagerly snatch up and eat an amputated arm. Who wouldn't? I mean, it's very delicious. Other times, they dance around the potential meal, rubbing it, but not grabbing it. And if they did grab it, they'd cling to the skin-free portion where the octopus arm has been cut from the body. And they'd hold the arm in the beaks. They have beaks instead of teeth, very gingerly, letting it dangle like a spaghetti noodle. So the researchers duped on this spaghetti holding. And in repeated tests, the researchers found that octopuses are more likely to behave strangely over their own arms, well, strangely in human terms, obviously, over their own arms than those of a stranger. So 95% of the time, octopuses will pull their suckers to grasp another octopus' amputated limb. They'll use the suckers on their own amputated limb less than 40% of the time. Likewise, octopuses treated another octopus' arm as food 72% of the time, compared with less than 28% of the time with their own arms. So octopuses would rather eat another octopus's arm than their own, but in 28 out of 100 times, they would also practice auto-cannibalism. Which again, due to the delicious nature of octopus arms, that is very understandable. So it seems that the chemicals used by octopus arms to avoid one another are specific to the individual, and the researchers have yet to isolate the precise secretions. Self-recognition is very common in nature. Immune cells, for example, must be able to differentiate between body cells and foreign invaders. If things go wrong, you have disorders like allergies, which, although not being the worst kind of autoimmune disease, provides enough suffering over the nicer season, mostly spring and summer of the year. So the amazing thing, at least to us humans, the octopus probably find that very self-explicable. Tribal about the octopus find is that these animals use chemical recognition in motor control. And the findings are reported in the journal Current Biology. Next story from Life Science on the findings of Rivera Perez from University of Puerto Rico. By evaluating the bacteria and fungi found in fossilized feces, microbiologists are providing evidence to help support archaeologists' hypothesis regarding culture living in the Caribbean over 1,500 years ago. They report their findings today at the annual meeting of the American Society for Microbiology. Fossilized feces, yes, that is feces, which is fossilized, or coprolites in Pseudo-Greek, have been frequently studied, but it's first time that have been used as tools to determine ethnicity and distinguish between two extinct cultures. By examining the DNA preserved in coprolites from two ancient indigenous cultures, the research group was able to determine the bacterial and fungal populations present in each culture as well as their possible diets. Various indigenous cultures inhabited the Greater Antilles thousands of years ago. The Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico have thousands of pre-Columbian indigenous settlements belonging to extinct cultures that migrated to the Caribbean at some point in history. So, archaeological excavations in Vieques, Puerto Rico, unearthed handmade tools and crafts as well as fossilized feces dating from 200 to 400 AD. The presence of two distinct styles of craftsmanship, as well as other clues obtained from the dig sites, suggested these artifacts belonging to two distinct cultures. One culture excelled in the art of pottery. In fact, their signature use of red and white paint helped identify them as descendants from the Salodoids originating in Saladero, Venezuela. In contrast, the second culture had exquisite art for crafting semi-precious stones into ornaments, some of which presented the Andean condor, so this helped archaeologists identify the Bolivian Andes as possible origins of this, what is called Heucoid culture. To help confirm this archaeological hypothesis, Rivera Perez and her colleagues examined the DNA preserved in coprolites from both Salodoids and Heucoid settlements and compared the bacteria and fungal populations found in each. Major differences were detected between the fecal communities of these cultures. Fecal communities, a different word for exiled gut flora. So these differences provide additional support that they may have had different origins. So additionally, they found fungal and corn DNA in the Heucoid coprolite that suggests the consumption of an Andean fermented corn beverage, further confirming the theory that the Heucoids originated in the Bolivian Andes. In summary, the study of the paleomicrobiome of the ancient gut bacterial of coprolites of stoned feces supports the hypothesis that of multiple ancestries and can provide important evidence regarding migration by ancestral cultures and populations of the Caribbean and maybe other places in Earth. Next story by Ed Young on National Geographic's phenomena. If a bumblebee is attacked by a thick-headed fly, it's doomed, which means it will die. The fly will lay an egg inside it and the larva will eat it alive, the bumblebee. And if that wasn't an ignoble enough fate, the larva also forces the bee to burrow into the ground. The soil is warm and safe and makes for a better nursery for the developing fly. And the bee, well, the bee is as good as dead. Well, it is a living dead, as you might call it. For its last act, it might as well dig its own grave, which it does. There are around 800 species of thick-headed flies or copepods, and they are all parasites. They use the hard tips of their abdomens to, like can openers, to prise apart the body segments of bees and wasps so they can lay an egg inside. They even do this while flying. A conoped can chase down a bee, grab it in mid-air, open it up, implant it with an egg without ever touching the ground. The fly maggot takes just under 2 weeks to kill its host, first by draining nutrients from its bodily fluids and then by actually eating it. And shortly after, it forms a pupae and transforms into an adult. In 1984, Christine Müller discovered that the vast majority of infested bumblebees bury themselves. As soon as she put them on soil, they started to dig. This behavior didn't matter to the bees, but it was critical for the flies. Conopeds have yearly life cycles. The adults emerge in the spring after spending the winter as pupae, hibernating inside their dead hosts. If the host dies in the open, the developing fly faces months of cold, dehydration, fungi, and other parasites. Which is just fair, isn't it? So if the host dies underground, the fly is sheltered and more likely to survive. These kinds of manipulations are common in the world of parasites, many of which commandeer the brains and bodies of their hosts to ensure their own survival. There are wasps that turn caterpillars into head-banging zombie bodyguards, and fungi that make ants climb to the ideal locations for spores to grow. And in this case, a fly turns the bee into a shovel and a grave. But not all bees make equally good shovels. In the summer of 2012, Rosemary Murphy at the University of Virginia collected three closely related species of bumblebees from a local field. She found that a quarter of them were parasitized by a single conopid species, a black wasp-like insect called Physocephala tibialis. The parasite forced all three species of bumblebee to dig, but with varying degrees of success. Around 70% of the two-spotted or common eastern bumblebees dug their own graves when infected, but only 18% of the brown-belted bumblebees did so. I'm not an expert in bumblebees, but you may know by the names and by the stripes and their patterns how much the bumblebees differ from each other. As a learned entomologist, if you may be or not. So this isn't a case of resistance in the classical sense. Host insects often have defenses that stop parasitic flies and wasps from implanting them with eggs. If that fails, their immune system can sometimes destroy the developing larva. And some species can even self-medicate with booze, nonetheless. For example, some flies, they normally eat yeast in rotten fruits, and often the yeast ferment in the absence of oxygen ferment the fruit into juice into alcohol, often containing up to 6% volume alcohol, and the flies themselves, they have a kind of defense system against intoxication, and it helps them to defend themselves against the wasps, which is also, of course, what humans or intelligent humans do. So these countermeasures can force parasites to be very specific, to only target hosts whose defenses they can overcome. Oh, by the way, I have lots of guests currently in my study. Apparently,
don't call us guests, we are groupies.
Yeah, they're groupies, obviously. Sorry for offending them. After the show in 8 minutes, we'll have an orgy. But we'll switch off the microphone. So, it's possible that the brown-belted bees in Murphy's study use one or more of these countermeasures, but they could also protect themselves. What am I talking about currently? Who knows? So, they could also protect themselves by resisting manipulations. So, if they don't dig their own graves, they'd make very poor winter homes for a conopid maggot and a poor choice of target for a conopid adult. So, perhaps I'm also defending myself against parasitic wasps. And perhaps they defend themselves from parasites not by being inhospitable hosts, just by being incompetent ones. Incompetence is one of my many strategies. As a side note. Next story by Virginia Hughes, also on Phenomena. The skin, the human skin, is our gateway to the physical world. And below its surface are ooze of nerve fibers relaying different types of messages to the brain. At the ends of the fingertips, for example, there's an all-you-can-destroy party here around. Below its surface are ooze of nerve fibers relaying different types of messages to the brain. At the ends of fingertips, for example, fat and fast A-beta nerves help you fish for keys at the bottom of a messy purse, or feel the difference between cotton and polyester. Nearby those big nerves are thinner and slower C fiber nociceptors, noci means pain, which transmit pain, and others that relay, for example, itchiness, and others that relay pressure, temperature, etc., etc. And there is yet another type of nerve found only under hairy skin that carries information about our social interactions. These nerves, known as C tactile, or in short, CT, not counter terrorist, C tactile, afferents are those nerves that carry information to our brain, respond to slow, gentle stroking, as a soft touch you'd give to a baby's forehead, or a lover's arm. No idea what that means. And some researchers believe that these fibers are crucial for the development of the social brain. A hand on the shoulder, a pat on the back or other body parts, just mentioned.
Yes.
Vagina.
Thank you. These things anchor and cement social relationships in a meaningful way. Sensations transmitted by the cecotactile afferent nerves.
In the penis.
Penis is, by the way, is a body part which is I have no idea why some people have problems.
Very special.
And totally not related to my current story. So CT nerves were first described in 1939. Swedish physiologist with the impossible Swedish pronounceable name, with the first name Soterman, found that in a cat's leg, certain thin nerve fibers. By the way, is there any way to delay the podcast? I'm not sure whether I want this to be immortalized on the internet.
You totally do, but you need to turn on this mic.
Yeah, if you want.
Is this Lingerham or
what? Now it's.
It's not
certain thin nerve fibers would fire electrical signals in response to slow stroking. Just listen to me, know those guys. The slow stroking with the edge of a round wooden pin. Subsequent studies confirm that those neurons exist in cats, as well as in monkeys and rats. They weren't reported in people until the late 1980s and 80s and 90s, which doesn't mean that we don't have them before, it's just we haven't discovered them. Thanks to a technique called microneurography pioneered by two Swedish scientists, Karl-Erik Hagbart and Akel Valbo, with this method, who cares? A metal electrode, tungsten. I will also put on the third microphone that you can hear everything that is going on inside.
Honestly,
no, they're turned off.
Now they're turned off.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, horrible! I can hear.
Hello. Show me your genitalia.
Yes, you must excuse my friends.
Genitalia.
That's probably.
Show me your genitals.
Whoop whoop. That's Italian for fingers, by the way. So, C-tech test. That's what we are talking about. Thanks to a technique called microneurography. With this method, a metal electrode, tungsten microelectrode, is poked through the skin. You don't have to show it if you want, sure, but I won't see it, so...
But you can do it if you really want.
Maybe we can have some private hours for that.
Honestly.
I'm always on labor for that. For science, of course.
And what about the children? Think about the children!
That's called education. So, deciphering back to the cecotactiles, which is a very important nerve. Deciphering the code of these nerves. By the way, I mean, it's already half. I have to go. Sorry for the...
Penis.
That was, by the way, Fiji for...
In the show. The penis in the show.
So, thank you. That was this week's Talking Science with me and lots of...
We could go on.
Of course.
The show must go on.
The show will go on, of course, with me, without me, but it will be more scientific than ever. I hope you enjoyed. If not, listen to the podcast again and again. Until
Hello,
you like
Kyle
it.
Erickson.
So, if you have any whatever, just
very nice.
That goes on. Also, just for my departure, I will play you out with some high quality silence for 15 seconds.
Actually, the podcast doesn't stop.
So that was your silence.
Entschuldigung.
That was your silence. Have fun.
Ja, der in der Stunde war ein bisschen, oder? Achso, eigentlich hat das eigentlich.